Today's episode is brought to you by our distribution partner, Virgil Films and Entertainment. Now, I've worked with Virgil personally, and I can tell you this is a company that champions independent filmmakers. With over 25 years of experience in film distribution and having partnered with brands like National Geographic, OWN, and Major League Baseball, their films, including the mega hot Super Size Me, the Oscar-nominated Restrepo, and the hit documentary Forks Over Knives, have landed on Netflix, Hulu, YouTube, Tubi, Apple TV, and more. They work directly with filmmakers and streaming platforms, and they offer a range of deals to fit different needs. They don't just distribute films, they elevate them. And truthfully, they're just really great people to work with. So if you want to learn more, head on over to virgilfilms.com. And now, on to the show. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Documentary First. My name is Christian Taylor. I'm your co-host. If you're listening, you know that that is the truth of the story. Anyway, I'm not doing our regular intro because I'm kind of tired of that. So anyway, we're going to jump right in. Today, I have a guest that I'm absolutely delighted to introduce you to. His name is Josh Roush. He's done a incredible movie called Long Lonesome Highway. I can't wait to tell everybody about it. I watched it yesterday, and it's about an actor that I think everybody should know about, but absolutely nobody does. His name is Michael Parks, and thanks to Josh, I hope that the world will get to know this guy. So Josh, thank you so much for being on the show. Really glad to have you.
Thank you for having me. I am so excited to do this.
Yeah, it's really going to be great. I told you your movie was so inspirational to me. I picked up the phone right away and I was like, hey, can I talk to you? Your movie did exactly what every filmmaker wants a movie to do. It encouraged me to do something, which was pick up the phone and say, hey, dude, I want to meet Michael Parks. I want to meet everybody else in your movie because I want them to tell me about working with Michael Parks. And, you know, I was really inspired by the work that you did, and I'm so grateful to get to talk to you today.
Well, I'm grateful that you had me on, so thanks so much.
All right, everybody, I'm going to read a little bit about Josh's bio, and then I'm going to just jump right in, and we're going to get to know a little bit more about him. So if you go to anticurrent.com, it's his website, you'll see exactly what I'm about to read you. But he lives in North Hollywood, California. He is actually a punk rock filmmaker, and everything listed on his site, there's a bunch of stuff there you can watch. He either wrote, directed, shot, edited, colored, composited, or sound design. Most of the time, he did everything all at once, which I asked him, and it is true, he did all of that for this film, Long Lonesome Highway. When he's not working on his own content, he's touring with some of the best punk rock bands in the business, or he's shooting music videos for them. He has directed one narrative feature, four documentaries, and over 30 music videos, several commercials, and quite a bit more. So in his young career, he's quite accomplished. He's yet another artist that we haven't heard about yet, but today I think we will hear a lot more. Josh, is that all true? Anything changed?
It seems so self-aggrandizing when you write it yourself for your website, but yes, it's all true.
That's awesome. So I want to know a little more. Why don't you take us back? You know, I think it's fascinating for how people got where they are. So tell me where you were born and how you got in this business in the first place.
I was born in a little place called Middletown, Ohio, so named because it is placed between between Cincinnati and Dayton. Middletown, we're a clever group out there. At 19, I got the punk rock itch and moved west, go west, young man. Joined a couple punk rock groups in Orange County, which is like my favorite scene on the planet. And then quickly got like disenchanted with the notion of like four sweaty, smelly, big egos in like a sweat box. And I was like, what can I do that's a creative endeavor that I don't have to answer to other people to? And I chose filmmaking, and come to find out it is a creative process. So now I just do everything myself.
So did you go to school or did you just teach yourself?
I did go to Cal State Fullerton for the film program. But honestly, you know, if I had it to do over, I wouldn't. I learned a lot. Don't get me wrong. But I learned twice as much, you know, boots on the ground, like being PAs or, you know, anything, honestly.
Yeah. Well, that's what Ken Burns said in his introduction, I say this again all the time. When I decided to start my documentary, I knew nothing, did not go to school. I was an actress, still an actress, but I thought, you know, I'm going to do this documentary. How hard can it be? I'll just watch, you know, Ken Burns' masterclass. And in the introduction, he basically was like, you know, just do it. Just get out there and do it. You know, forget film class. You just need to do it. And film class is good and helpful, but you really learn by doing.
Yeah. And I mean, just watch the things you love. Like, I mean, you know, mimic a style until you invent your own style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So what are you most proud of?
Oh, God. I mean, Wrong Reasons, my narrative feature, I'm very, very proud of, because like between writing to putting it out the door, I think it was like a 10-year journey. And it's a giant love letter to punk rock. But really, I think I'm the most proud over this documentary, just because like I get to put a light on my friend who's passed away.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's just jump right in. You took us to that. So this documentary, Long Lonesome Highway, it is a story about an actor named Michael Parks who did pass away. And it is a tribute to everything he was. And, you know, when I called you yesterday, I called because it so resonated with me that I told you that I just recently lost my mom.
Sorry to hear that.
And I was so touched that you, as a young man, spent time with Michael at his end of his life and had the ability to see beyond his crustiness and his, you know,
this was ample.
prickliness, to see the richness of his soul, and that you, even though it was difficult, you were able to mine and appreciate who this man was. And not only that, take the mantle of his life to share it with the world. And I just was so impressed with that, because more than your movie, I think I want people to hear that you took this on as a passion project.
Sure.
And you took this on with your own money. I heard with your own time. And there's a lot of filmmakers out there who wonder if that's, you know, if they should do it. And maybe you wondered that. Yeah. And I just want to say, I feel like what you did was worth it. It was worth the time and it was worth the money. And anyway, just wanted to say that.
Well, we tried to get this off the ground several times before we eventually had luck with it. Because Michael, you know, he was a dear friend of mine, a sweet man, huge pain, pain in the ass. He wanted like $25,000 to do it. And I was just like, buddy, like, that's not how documentaries work. They're celebrating your legacy. It's bigger than money. He's like, hey, show me the bottom line. I'm like, all right. So I actually found the money, and like, we were getting it off the ground. And about that point, the financier got busted dealing some kind of drug that was like legal, but it was a very gray area. And he went to federal pen. So that went away. So I ended up just having to pick up the pieces and do it myself after he passed.
Wow. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So you met him. Tell me how long you've been working on this film.
It's been about 10 years from Soup to Nut. Yeah, it's been about 10 years. A lot of that time was spent, you know, I'll just address the elephant in the room. Quentin Tarantino's not in the film. We shot this during COVID. So like, it was always a question. It was always told to us when, not if, we get Tarantino.
Now let's talk about why Quentin Tarantino is kind of pivotal here and why you needed him.
Tarantino once said that Michael Parks was the greatest living actor on the planet. So he put him in a ton of productions. They were very good friends. They actually like shot pool together before Tarantino even had a name for himself. But where was I going with that? I'm sorry.
You were saying that you couldn't get him in the film, and you were waiting to get him in the film. And so, why was he pivotal to this?
So we kept kicking the can down the road, or he kept kicking the can down the road of his involvement. And eventually, you know, lawyer's fees piled up, and we just had to get it out the door. Like, we just had to call it. It's like, you know, we wanted you to be part, so sorry you're not. It's all good. And we just had to move on without him, unfortunately.
That's too bad.
I agree. I fully agree. And, you know, nobody was none too happy about it. But unfortunately, at some point, you just got to.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And, you know, you were able to bring what he said in there, because Michael said it himself. And Michael did talk about, in fact, you know, he was the one that discovered his writing. Right. Yeah. I think. And went way, way, way back when, and said he was a good writer. And that was an interesting connection. And yeah. So
if he hasn't done anything, he doesn't know everything, is what he said. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so, you know, he was in there, and, so, you know, you were saying it was 10 years it took you. So tell me when he passed.
Oh God, I'm so bad at dates. Everything's just a big blur in my life. I want to say it was 2014. I want to guess.
Okay. So you were working on Tusk.
Yeah.
And you were working with him. And so and Kevin Smith is the director of Tusk.
Mm-hmm.
And he had put Michael Parks in that film because yeah. Kevin Smith had learned to love Michael Parks.
Yeah. From Quentin's movies. I was actually on Tusk as a behind the scenes, like, kind of filmmaker. Excuse me. As a behind the scenes, like, kind of documentarian on the movie. And, you know, it became quickly apparent that Michael, like, was not in good health. And, you know, he had suffered some brain damage from a big fall. So they needed somebody to just kind of babysit him, for lack of a better term. And, you know, it started out as just this young, angry punk rocker and this old curmudgeon sitting in a trailer, kind of not really digging each other. And then he just, like, started singing to me one day. And I was like, I looked around, I'm like, I'm the only person here. And he just keeps singing to me. And I'm just like, that's an old Johnny Cash tune. He's like, oh, you like Cash? I knew Cash. I'm like, go on. Like, continue, please.
Tell me more.
Yep, 100%. And then, you know, come to find out he knew Lenny Bruce. He knew Martin Luther King. And like not just knew, he was friends with these people.
Yeah.
Like, some, like, movers and shakers of, like, the 60s and 70s. And, I mean, just culture in general. But, like, you know, the second you tell me, you know, those kind of people, I'm just enamored.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I loved about you. I could tell right away you were a curious guy. It doesn't surprise me that, you know, you're like, what? Because, that was what was so interesting about him. He was not at all, braggadocious.
Yeah.
And he was not going to, let his ego really, he wanted you to recognize who he was without being showy, you know? Yep. And
he would try to draw you in like a way. He'd be like, oh yeah, me and my buddy Lenny. And I'm just like, wait, San Francisco? Wait, you mean Lenny Bruce? He's like, I said Lenny, weren't you listening to me?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, dude, like, humble brag, but like,
you know. Yeah, exactly. And
draw you in, like. Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's what's so interesting about him, because if you had not stopped to listen, or if you were not curious, all of that would have gone by. And,
sure.
You know, I guess maybe I've worked now with World War II filmmakers. If people listen, they know I've and I sit there and they're 100 years old. And so when they say something that they've been here or been there or done this, you know, 90 years ago, I'm like, what? You know, and it's fascinating. You're sitting there realizing, oh my gosh, I have live history here. Somebody can tell me this. Tell me more. I can't read that in a book.
Yeah.
And yes, you had a wonderful opportunity. You were living with history.
Yeah. And you said something on the phone call yesterday that I very much agree with. We're very dismissive of older people a lot of the time. Like, we don't take the time to listen or care, or it's just like, okay, old man, like, you know, move on.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's so stupid, because, like, they have so much life experience, and, like, I'm 40. I don't know shit still. Like, you know, please teach me all you can.
Yeah. Well, so keep going. I mean, he sang to you, and I did hear in the film you say, you know, we kind of didn't like each other, and he didn't like you either. So it started to make that turn when he started singing to you. And so keep going.
Yeah. And then, you know, just slowly I'd pull these stories out of him, and, you know, like I said, he wasn't in the best mental health at the time. So it was, you had to really sit and lean into it and pay attention. But, you know, then he'd start just giving me second, third hand recollections of like James Dean and just all these actors and all these producers and directors and artists and musicians, like, that just meant the absolute world to me. And like, I think because he recognized that I recognized good talent, like not just him, but like other people, it kind of lowered his like wall a little bit. And he kind of let me in, to the point to where, like, you know, I became the person, I don't think we talk about it in the doc, but I'd have to sneak him whiskey on set. So like, you know, I'd distract Kevin over here, go to the liquor store, fill up his coffee cup. And then I'd have to like ply him before he'd go on stage.
Hilarious.
Yeah. He was ornery.
Well, it's so, yeah, that's so interesting, because I remember in the doc, he did say, he did remark about you, you know, something about how he really liked you, or you were a good guy or something. He made some positive comment about you.
He also compared me to a walrus. So
yes, that's true. That's true.
He's kind of a dick.
What did he mean by that?
It is just something funny to say in the moment, because the walrus is all scarred up in the movie and stuff. He'd always say to me, like, where do you got all that shit on your jacket? I'm like, I don't know, old man. Why are you so curmudgeonly? Like,
oh, I bet you had the sweetest relationship.
We did. I mean, yeah, like I would literally just go over to his house and just sit and chill with him and listen to stories. And then inevitably we'd go get margaritas or something. I think I helped him move house 3 or 4 times, like from different like rental units. Like he'd get a deal on a rental unit, then a new deal 3 months later. So we'd have to take all this crap and put it in the other one. He meant the world to me. I wouldn't have done that for everybody.
So how long were you friends with him then before he passed? And then when did you decide I'm going to make a documentary?
I mean, I think I had the idea probably during Tusk. Like it was probably the genesis of the idea, but I don't think I tried to do anything about it until we came back home and we hung out another couple times. Like he would call me up and, you know, what are you doing, kid? Come on over. And like, so it was probably during one of those sit down coffees or margaritas or beers or whatever we were into that week, that I actually approached him with the idea, and he was all about it. He's like, as long as I get paid. And I'm like, oh my God, what are you doing to me?
Oh, so funny. Well, you know, it sounds like to me, I mean, in this doc, you brought in his son, mm-hmm. Which was really, I mean, and I think, was it his daughter or a stepdaughter?
Adopted daughter.
Adopted daughter.
Yeah.
So those two were helpful, I think, yeah. In pushing along the story, particularly his son. Yeah. I didn't get until later in the film that he was actually an actor as well, because I didn't know him. And I didn't understand that his father really had kind of led him down that road. But that was really neat to see. And, you know, it was a kind of a beautiful relationship that began to develop between the two of them.
Sure.
And I'm sure his son was helpful to you in telling the story. Yeah.
Yeah. Trisha, you know, his daughter was just the ultimate cheerleader, and she still is. Like she reshares everything I do, everything I post. The whole family are just sweethearts of human beings. James and I, like, I don't think we knew how to deal with each other at first, because like he is his actual son, but like I'm, you know, almost in this adopted grandfatherly kind of thing. But all it took was like a few drinks and just talking shit on his dad. And we immediately were just like, okay, cool. Like we love each other. And yeah. Since then he starred in my movie, Wrong Reasons.
Oh, that's so awesome. Yeah. You know, it sounds like, I mean, I've been doing a little bit of research, but you've kind of got this family of people that have been doing projects together. And it kind of, it's got Kevin Smith and now you've got James. Yeah. And yeah, James. You. And there's other people in this little family.
Sure.
So tell me how all that came together.
I mean, I started as a fan of Kevin 15 years ago, something like that. Probably, oh, God, more than that. Time is just not linear to me. It all just meshes together. But I started as a fan. I would go to poker nights. If you bought like $300 in merch, because he's always selling his face on stupid products, you could play poker with him. So like I got in and everybody was like infatuated with him to kind of like this kind of crazy level. And I was just like making a lot of money playing poker. And like, So I'd keep going back. And I think I did that like 7 or 8 times. And eventually he's like, man, you're a really big fan. I'm like, look at my chip stack right now, dude. Like, I am a big fan, but like, I'm kind of making coin over here. I think that impressed him. And eventually a guy named JC Reifenberg was shooting his podcasts. And there was like a Twitter call, like, hey, you know, can anybody come run a camera? So I started doing crowd camera on a lot of his podcasts. And then that became me actually running one of his podcasts. And then that became me doing the behind the scenes on his movies. And it just kind of like, I mean, I've worked with Kevin in so many capacities. I was his daughter's bodyguard for 2 years.
Like, wow.
Yeah. Like, just, you know, so you need something done, call Josh.
Yeah.
But,
and so that then, that kind of leads to, you know, let's do projects together, I suppose.
Truly. Yeah. And like, you know, he's always like, he was the king of the DVD, the Blu-ray. So he always loved having a lot of behind the scenes. So I became the, like, because those bonus features and documentaries on movies I love, you know, meant so much to me. I was like, hey, can I take that role now that the old guy kind of moved on? And that is what led me into narrative feature length stuff.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. I mean, gosh, your poker playing really helped you with your film career.
Really. And I'm not even that good. It's just that they were that bad.
That's pretty awesome. That's great. I love it. Well, it's so interesting because everybody's path to filmmaking is different. That's what that shows you, you know, yep. And it also shows you, you just have to take risks and follow opportunity, you know, where it is, because you just really never know. I'm sure he's been a big fan and a big help of what you're doing as well. Yeah.
Oh yeah, for sure. He did help finance Long Lonesome Highway. Kevin is like, just, you know, I talk shit about him because he's a good friend. And if I don't talk shit about somebody, then I probably don't like you. But like, he is just like the best dude on the planet, the most generous, the sweetest, lends his name out, more importantly, like, which is, you know, big in this industry. Yeah, I can't say enough good things about the boy.
That's awesome. That's
he's
awesome.
Also a pain in the ass too, but
the best ones usually are. The best ones usually are.
True.
Okay, so, you know, you decided that you're going to make this movie. You couldn't get Quentin Tarantino, so you decide you're going to move it along. Michael wants $25,000 to make this movie. You're like, I can't really do this. So you really can't get started until after he passes. Okay, so he passes. Now you're like, okay, I can do this movie. Now, your movie has a lot of it has a lot of archival, like a lot of photos, really, really, really cool photos. I loved the archival photos of him.
Thank you.
Just
a lot of research.
Yeah, great archival. You've got great movie clips. Just super, super awesome stuff, which, I mean, that archival is not easy, particularly if you don't have an ARC producer. So yeah. How did all that happen?
Thank God for fair use in the United States. I'll say that. We got Donaldson and Califf, I think, were our lawyers. And, like, they're the name in fair use. So, you know, it was so weird because, like, we finished this project, like, probably 7 years ago. And we were, you know, waiting on Tarantino to add him to the documentary. Never got him. When we decided we had to move on, we had to re-clear everything with the lawyers. So that was a brand new lawyer bill and stuff. And in the process, it kind of worked out better because some of the photos, I guess the photo rights in the United States for fair use have changed. So they're less liable to clear you for fair use if it's a photo than it is if it's a clip. So a lot of the photos of Lou Wasserman that were in the original edit became clips, like with him on stage with like Alfred Hitchcock, because like more sources had become available from the Academy and stuff like that. So like it really kind of worked in our benefit from like a, you know, a movie making perspective to have waited that time, because like a lot of the photos got subbed out with like real clips. But yeah, like I just bought everything Michael Parks on eBay, on Amazon, on like bootleg DVD websites, ripped everything myself, up converted it as much as possible. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So why don't you tell our listeners about fair use? Because sure. That can be very confusing and difficult to understand.
Sure. Fair use is basically implied in the Constitution that anything that is relevant in our culture can be used to comment on. So we can comment on that thing. So we can reuse a piece of media, be that a movie or whatever, as long as we're talking about why it's socially unique or interesting or transformative in our culture.
Right. But there are limits to that.
Yes.
So yeah. What are the limits?
Well, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so don't take me, completely literally, but I it's usually under 30 seconds. You have to have somebody talking about why, you have to transform the piece and talk about why it's culturally relevant or socially relevant to it. So you can't just throw in a Michael Parks clip. You have to have somebody talking about his role in that thing or why he's an actor making those choices in that clip, kind of.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, you did have a lot of his stuff in there. So yeah. So basically what you're saying is you really didn't have to pay for the archival that you were using.
Truly. There was a few photos that we had to pay rights for because Lou Wasserman's, family, I heard, were particularly litigious. But other than that, we didn't really pay for very many clips at all.
Okay. Yeah. Now, another thing I noticed was there wasn't a lot of music, or you didn't rely a lot on soundtrack or music, right? Talk to me about what you decided to do where music was concerned.
Well, my buddy Cam Masavian scores everything I've ever done. We're in a band together called Empired, and he's just one of my nearest and dearest. So he did the score for this, as well as Wrong Reasons and all the other stuff. So there is a little bit of music through line, but music gets kind of crunchy when it comes to fair use. They're very, very litigious, and they'll come after you in a heartbeat. So we used a couple tracks of Michael's because he had six albums.
And yeah. Let's talk about that. I mean, sure. he was a singer. You talked about, he sang to you in his, his trailer. I was so shocked to hear that he was also a singer. I mean, that's just amazing.
Yeah. He was a man of all seasons. He could literally do anything. And he would just get real silent and still, and then look at you and then just recite poetry right into your face. It was really intimidating and weird and beautiful. And I've never met a creature like this on the planet.
Yeah.
That's
great. Yeah. So you did use some of his stuff, but briefly, really.
Very briefly.
Yeah.
I mean, if we would have had a budget, this would have been a whole different documentary. This was just doing the best we could with what we had.
Well, I mean, I will tell you, your budget was, you want to say what your budget was?
It was 40 that ended up being about 50 after we went through lawyer's fees a second time.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's impressive, really, really impressive that you made this film for that amount of money. I've been talking to my distributor and he's telling us these days, do not make anything over $200,000 if you want to see any profit. And, it's tough even at 50K to see any profit. I know that because I've been trying to make a profit on my film and I spent over 500K and it's taken me, 8 years to see, profit from anything. We're still not there. So, it's really amazing that you made this film with that little money. And, kudos to you for that.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, of course I want, Kevin to get his money back and I want to get my money back, but profit was never the motivation for this. I knew that it's probably never going to make any money. When we came out last month on DVD, the distributor was just how much do you want to sell it for? I was the bare minimum. What will you let me sell this for? Right. So I think it's on Amazon for $10.81 because they were just what are you doing? And I was just it's not about that. I mean, I know it should be, but it's not for me. I just want, if that $2-3 extra is going to make a difference, if somebody buys it, sell it cheaper. I could give a damn. Put it, torrent it. Please steal my movie. I'm happy with it.
Yeah, it's a great film, actually. And can anyone stream it yet? Are you still working on that?
Still working on that. I think at the end of the month, it'll probably come out to SVOD, AVOD, all the ad-based, or, you could probably purchase it on Amazon and iTunes for $9.99 or something like that.
Yeah, well, we're going to help with that if we can. So
hopefully
we can get you there. Well, I always ask filmmakers, is there anything you would like to talk about that I haven't asked you? What behind the scenes stories would you like to share? Or what was the most difficult thing that you overcame? Or what are the thing you most proud about in this film?
I mean, the thing I'm most proud about is just that we got it out the door and that I think it does a service to Michael's legacy. What I would like to talk about is that I hate that I'm in it. Like, I suck in front of a camera. Like, I suck on this interview. I'm so good behind the camera. The second you put one in front of me, I'm garbage. But I screened an early cut of this where I'm not involved in it to a guy named Scott Mosier. He directed he produced a documentary called Band Called Death, which is a fantastic punk rock documentary. But he was Kevin's producer for like years and years. And I screened it for him. He was just like, it's not great, dude. He's like, why do I care about this? You're just showing clips of this old guy. I need a through line to connect me to the person. He's like, you need to be in it. I'm like, the fuck I do. Like, wrong guy. He's just like, look, if you're not in it, I don't care. He's like, get over yourself and put yourself in it. So I had to.
And listen, you were talking to a woman who said the exact same thing about her film. And I'm going to say that I completely agree with him. You are wrong about yourself. You are fantastic here because you know why? You're you. You're you. You're nobody else. And you're intriguing and you're interesting because you're you. You're not trying to be anybody else. In that film, you know, it did take me a while to figure out, oh, hey, wait a minute. It's this guy that decided to make this film because he saw something in Michael Parks. It took me a while to figure it out. But by the end, I was like, I've got it. And then I was like, wow. So he was right. But here's the thing. There's a line in La La Land. And then people laugh at me when I bring this up. La La Land is one of my favorite movies. Shame to admit it, but it's true. La La Land was the inspiration for my film, The Girl Who Wore Freedom, which is a World War II documentary. Makes no sense. Except there's this wonderful line in there where Mia is telling Sebastian, you know, initially that she hates jazz, you know, and he's like, what? You hate jazz? You know, basically she doesn't know what jazz is. In the end, you know, he goes and joins this band, which is really new jazz. And she asks him, you know, why are you doing this? Don't you love jazz? And he's like, well, you don't even like jazz. And she goes, I do like jazz. I like jazz because you like jazz. You made me like jazz. You know, you people like jazz because you love jazz, you know, and it's true. Like when we have a passion about something and we share our passion with other people, it makes other people love it. It's because, you know, we can see through your eyes. And that's what happened in this movie. I was able to see through your eyes, this wonderful person. And that would not have happened if you took yourself out, really, because we would not have been able to see what you see. You saw
something. I suck in front of a camera.
but the thing is, you know, that's the thing. We have to get beyond that. And the only way that I know that is I'm a voiceover actor as well. And so I started off being the same thing. Oh, I sound terrible. Oh, I'm awful. I'm the same way in front of a camera. I suck. I look terrible. I can't do this.
Oh, you're great.
What we're doing is we have this idea of who we are or who we should be or what we should look like. And we're judging ourselves from the outside and thinking that other people are judging us. And what I saw in that movie is that I saw a young man who has a tender heart, who appreciates, has the ability to appreciate a man that other people did not. And for me in this life, that is what is valuable. And, you know, what's so amazing about Michael Parks and what I learned is that he was a man before his time. That's the thing. You know, what happened in this film, what we learned is he was this amazing actor, like Quentin Tarantino said, but he blew up his acting career because he told his amazing agent to take a hike and he didn't want to make this certain movie. And so, he got this reputation of being difficult to deal with, didn't get cast during the most castable time in his life. And, you know, he had this reputation. Now, these days, right, people want that spirit. Yeah. They want that fight. They want that individuality. He's an overcomer. That's why at the second stage of his life, he began to be wanted because he was thinking for himself, right? All of these actors now who've become directors or producers or whatever, it's commonplace because they don't want to be thought as actors that are just told to do something. They have a brain. They have a point of view. They have, and they want to have say. And that's where we've come in our society. He was just ahead of his time. And
agreed. Yeah. I mean, I wanted just the movie as a whole to be an exercise in, like, you know, if you're going to do it your own way, there can be consequences.
True.
Because, like, you know, I worked at Sony for 9 years and I was just like, I can't do corporate anymore. I got to get out of this. And, like, I started making films and stuff my own way. But I'll probably never be hugely commercially successful because I'm doing it my own way. I refuse to, like, cater and do all the crap that, like, you know, most people usually get behind to be successful. And I'm just like, I'd rather just have a low threshold of success and eke by an existence and do it my way. So I think I saw a lot of that in him.
Sure. And you know, truthfully, what you're saying there is, what do I value in life?
Yeah.
Right? At some point, you made a decision of what was most important to you and looked at what the world decides as success and decides, you know what? I don't want that. Yep. I want a different quality of life and I want to enjoy my life and I'm going to try to do the best I can. And that may mean I'm successful and it may not, but I'm going to be happy while I'm doing it.
True.
And, you know, I do think that, I hope in society, you know, that we can begin to be more like that. I mean, Michael Parks did that. He accepted the consequences of that. And what was so fascinating is that there were lots of consequences in his life. Like, it was crazy to me. He lost his brother.
Yeah.
He lost a child. He lost a wife. He had such incredible loss. He lost a career.
Yeah.
Several times. Yeah. So he suffered so much loss. And then at one point near the end of his life, he lost his body. Like, he had a huge accident and he was in a coma and his body was broken. You know, I mean, this guy was an overcomer. Mm-hmm. You know, I wrote this down. He was true to himself, but he had a rich life. He was a man before his time, you know, and like you have Kurt Russell in your movie saying, like, Kurt Russell talking about this dude, how he looked up to him, and Kurt Russell's son.
Yeah.
And who else do you have?
Justin Long. Yeah.
Long talking about, I think that was hilarious. Justin Long's relationship to him was similar to yours, right?
Truly. Yeah. None of us knew how to handle him when he came to Tusk. Cause, like, you know, he's a legend in a lot of people's eyes, but also, like, he was hard to have a conversation with because of the brain trauma. That came across as a lot of aggressiveness from him for a little bit. Like, you can see it in the outtakes of Tusk. Like, what the fuck is the line? Like, he really kind of, that poor script supervisor, man. Like, I shook his hand afterwards. I was like, buddy, you did the Lord's work, man. You got through it.
Yeah.
He's just like, thank you for saying that.
Well, you know, he was so accomplished at memorizing lines. He was so accomplished at character stuff. And I can imagine how frustrating it must have been for him to not have that capacity anymore.
Truly, truly. And doing that work, and we talk about it in the doc, really kind of pulled him out of that stupor and brought him back to, like, I'd probably 60-70% capacity, which, you know, for a guy like that is still got to be hard, but, like, you could get the stories out of him a lot easier. You could, like, he'd sing a lot clearer. It was really unique to see somebody kind of overcoming brain trauma in real time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you don't get to see that very often.
No, I mean, that's what I'm saying. You know, he was an incredible lesson in so many ways if you stop to look at his life. And that's what I thought was so interesting in your film. And, you know, you look at his life and you're like, holy shit. Like, if you stop to look at what he overcame, like, he could have quit at so many places.
Yeah.
He could have just quit life. He could have taken his life. He could have quit working. He could have blown up. And maybe there were phases where he did not function well in relationships or whatever. I'm sure he's human.
Yeah.
But he got back up. Yep. He got back up on that horse, or he got back up on that motorcycle. He kept riding, right?
Totally.
And I just think there's just so much to love. One of my, I'm going to end with this. My favorite thing, and you started with it and you ended with it, was what he said. The five stages of an actor.
Yep.
That was brilliant.
Oh,
brilliant.
I mean, we didn't have a lot of footage of the man, so that podcast became so crucial. And I was in the audience for that podcast as a fan that day. So, like, I knew the content was there, which is a reason that I go back to it a lot. But, yeah.
If you don't mind, I'm going to play that on
our podcast. Sure. Oh, my God. Please, please.
I would love to play, you know, some little clips. I'm not even going to say what the five stages of an actor are because I want to play it. But it's so powerful as an actress because it's so true.
Yeah.
But it's not just about an actor. It's almost just about anybody in the creative field, really.
100%.
And, you know, if you, as a creative person, live for that, I don't think you'll live.
Yeah, truly.
Because I don't think that you can live your life trying to, achieve the five stages of an actor.
Yeah,
and I agree. You know, I really don't. Because he didn't.
Yep, agreed.
He didn't make those five stages, really.
Yep. Yeah, I just want to leave behind some cool stuff when I depart, and I think he was the same way.
Yeah, well, he left a lot of cool stuff behind, and you're 40. You're 40, and you are. No, I'm about to be 59 in December. I can't even say those words, but
I'm a very hard 40. It's been a rough one.
Well, you've got a lot of years ahead of you, I hope, and I hope you will keep making movies.
I definitely will.
And
I can't thank you enough for having me on. This has been spectacular. And any time I get a chance to shine a light on Michael, I really am appreciative.
Well, we are going to shine a light on him. I want other people to know who he is. And if you guys get a chance, please, you got to see this movie. So we're going to find a way. We're going to put links here underneath, you know, our comments. We're going to share things on social media. Hopefully, you know, you can reshare them too. Hopefully you'll get some of the people in your film to reshare them too. That will help us.
Truly.
So we'll try to get the word out there.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Super nice to meet you. Now we have to do one other thing. It's our favorite segment. It's called DocuView Deja Vu.
Okay.
All right. In this segment, we ask our guests to bring a documentary to share with people. So think about a documentary that you like that you think our listeners or viewers, if they're watching, should see.
Burden of Dreams by Werner Herzog.
Why?
Because it is a man against nature, man against self, man against society, overcoming the stupidest of self-imposed situations because just refusing to give up in the face of everything going wrong at once. I think it's just a testament to like what creative can be while also showcasing how stupid it can be. and Werner Herzog's a god to me. So anything by him is great.
Well, I've never heard of that. So thank you very much for that recommendation.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. You've heard it from Josh. Got to make sure you check it out. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell and you can be the one to tell it. Bye, everybody.
You know the five stages of an actor. The first stage is, who's Michael Parks? Second stage is, get me Michael Parks. Third stage is, get me a Michael Parks type. And fourth is, get me a young Michael Parks. And fifth stage is, who's Michael Parks?
Hey, everybody. This podcast is brought to you by Documentary First Productions, and we need your support so that we can keep preserving history. If you could go over and grab some merch or watch our films at documentaryfirst.com, you'll help us keep making awesome documentaries and sharing the stories that matter, and also bring amazing filmmakers and their wonderful films to the world. So thank you so much for listening, and thank you for visiting documentaryfirst.com.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.